Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI.
And I'm Zoe Weaver-Lee, a program associate at GTI.
And today we're so excited to be joined by Rashid Griffith, a non-resident senior fellow with the Asia and Latin America program at the Inter-American Dialogue. He also serves as a co-founder and chief operating officer at Merkle Hedge, a Canadian financial technology and trading firm. In addition to all his work at the Dialogue, he's a visiting research fellow at Future Forum, a director of the Caribbean ASEAN Council, and a George Mason University Emergent Ventures Fellow. He's also the host of the fantastic China and the Americas podcast, which I would really encourage everyone to check out on Spotify. Rashid, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello, Marshall. Hi, Zoe.
Well, Rashid, really glad you could join us today to discuss a really important, but I think undercovered, at least in the Asia sphere, region for both Taiwan and China, which is the Caribbean. For Taiwan, the area has really become one of its last remaining bastions of formal diplomatic support, with several diplomatic allies in the region. At the same time, however, the Caribbean has really become a key target of Chinese economic and diplomatic activity in the Americas. For leaders in both Taipei and Beijing, and of course those in Washington, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Caribbean has really become a crucial region for all of them. With that in mind, we're so excited to have you here to share your really considerable expertise on this really important and interesting topic. Well, just to get started, I always like to kind of set the stage a bit. What is the current state of affairs between China, Taiwan, and the United States in the Caribbean? How do they interact with these countries in the region, and how has that changed over time?
Well, the stage is wide and dimly lit. I think that's the best way to phrase the actual contours of the argument, in the sense that usually when people think about the Caribbean, they have merely a vague notion of what that constitutes. That could be, for example, countries like Barbados. Sometimes people include Haiti, but people tend to forget Belize, or they tend to forget Dutch Caribbean or French Caribbean countries. And all of these are in the same region. And of course, because of the historical baggage the region has, they have very different orientations towards foreign policy, where have Dutch Caribbean countries have essentially foreign policy made in Holland, and you have French Caribbean countries where foreign policy is primarily made in Paris, and so on. So in that case, the way how you think about the Caribbean in terms of multiple angles is it's almost a bit hard to explain in a very short way. And sometimes people, because it's so difficult, tend to avoid the question entirely. But I think to get a very good picture of the Caribbean foreign policy as a aggregate conceptualization, you have to take all of these things into consideration. But usually when people think about the Caribbean and China and Taiwan and the US, they usually think of the thing we call the Caribbean community, which is a semi-formal political community. There's no, I guess there's no good comparison. Perhaps like Mercosur in South America would be a good example of similarity. But essentially it is these countries that we typically mean the Caribbean: Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, the smaller Caribbean countries, the Eastern Caribbean, Belize, Guyana, so on. And in that case, from these countries' perspective, the relationships they have with the China, US, and Taiwan, of course, are very complicated, because there are some countries that can't even agree on where China is or is not. And that is obviously what I'm sure we'll get into today.
That's great. Thank you so much for providing such a in-depth context. And it leads us really nicely into this next part of the discussion, where we'd like to highlight more about Taiwan's formal diplomatic partners in the region, which it has seen dwindle over the years. So despite that, the Caribbean has remained one of its few strongholds of diplomatic support, including its five full allies in the region, being Haiti, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Belize. So how would you characterize Taiwan's relationships with these countries?
The complication is that small Caribbean countries typically, and I know this is not usually said, simply have very poor frameworks for foreign policy design and implementation. So when it comes to any country, be it Taiwan, be it US, be it England, be it France, the real way of thinking about foreign policy isn't in this idea of strategy or policy, in my view. I think it's more political ties. And sometimes these go as simple as fraternal ties, as in who actually is in charge, and therefore the person in charge is generally the person in charge of the party, which is in charge of the government, which decides on a whim who its friends and allies or non-allies are. So, for example, you would have St. Lucia. So, St. Lucia is currently a Taiwan ally, formally, but as you might know, or should know, that St. Lucia was temporarily not a Taiwan ally. St. Lucia established relations with Taiwan in 1984, and then broke off in 1997 in favor of Beijing, and then reaffirmed relations with Taiwan in 2007. And that's because of a political switch in government. The people who are in charge decide what the foreign policy is. There's no eternal friends or eternal foes, you know, in Caribbean foreign policy, essentially speaking. So in that sense, that's why you will see, for example, this long-running, or what people call stronghold, of Taiwan allies in the region. But in reality, I guess a better way of viewing it is the people who are in charge have been there for a long time, and the people who become in charge under them are also influenced by their own, by the original person's view of how foreign policy should work. So again, in St. Vincent and the Grenadines, the prime minister has been in charge for about 21 years. There is no valid opposition in the country. There is no real institutional independence from any of the court systems or the other systems you will generally call state arms. And, you know, there are famous statements where people in that region have, you know, in that country have said, all roads lead to the prime minister. And in that instance, it is not a matter of why the country is a Taiwan ally. It's a matter of why the prime minister remains interested in being a Taiwan ally. That's a very different question, which I think is not usually posed enough.
I'd actually be curious to follow up on that. You know, do you have a sense of, when you mentioned that these are very personalistic foreign policies, they're really related to what that individual prime minister or leader feels. Do you have a sense of why some of these countries and why some of these specifically leaders are in support of Taiwan?
It's likely, again, because when they were coming into power or coming into the world, the Caribbean in general has only had very strong relations with even PRC as early as the 80s, like really strong relations. There have been some exceptions, like Guyana, for example, which had relations with PRC since 1960s. Granted, others have formal ties since then, but nothing really was implemented until the 80s or so. So Guyana, in Guyana's instance, the rationale was that the leader of Guyana at the time, which is towards independence, Forrest Burnham, was a very pro-Marxist, pro-communist, pro-North Korean philosophy of many things. And there's some very good historical papers about how a lot of the Guyanese people would go to North Korea for mass games, participation, or how, for example, a lot of North Koreans would come to Guyana to help build certain things. So those kind of ties are why that kind of old communist third world philosophy was there in the Caribbean from a very early stage. But that didn't really mean too much in most other Caribbean countries. Only until the 80s or so, when many Caribbean countries were really doing more ties with PRC, then you see ties start to really deepen. But at the same time, many of the leaders in the Caribbean were more pro the ideas that the leadership of Taiwan at the time were talking about. And that's when they kind of came into politics. So historical reasons, they just have a very more, say, a more inclined calling towards a lot of the older, mostly Kuomintang party politics, party philosophies that when they were younger people, they got more exposed to. And that's because those are the same people who are in charge of the country now. They had no reason to switch over.
Really fascinating, and not something that I've really thought about in the past. Be curious, you know, as Zoe mentioned earlier, Taiwan's list of allies has really been shrinking in recent years, mm-hmm. particularly in, you know, Latin America, where, you know, you've seen Nicaragua and several other countries switch over their recognition in recent years. And then even in recent days, you've seen movements in, you know, talk in Paraguay and Honduras about potentially switching over. I'd be curious to hear, I mean, it sounds so different in the Caribbean with this very personalistic, you know, this very individualized approach to foreign policy. And you also mentioned that a lot of these leaders have been in power for some time. Do you think that's going to be the case going forward? I mean, do you think there'll be a switch anytime in the future, or will this current sort of quote-unquote stronghold for Taiwan endure into the near future?
I think that the switches will probably come quite quickly and around the probably same time across the board. Now, if I were to ask, or I'm asked this all the time actually, so I'm asked, well, what is the benefit of switching to the PRC over Taiwan? People would say, okay, well, the PRC gives you various investment projects, they give you loans, they give you various terms like that. Now, those are fine examples, but the problem is that always misses the big, fundamental, most important impact the PRC has on Caribbean countries. And it has nothing to do with loans or construction or infrastructure. It is this. If you go to anywhere in the Caribbean, like most countries on Earth, but especially Caribbean, you will see everything made in China. Now, people kind of gloss over what that fact means. That fact means that by the pure existence of care of Chinese PRC companies operating in the world, primarily to European markets and US markets, the Caribbean buys these products for cheaper costs. For countries like the Caribbean, who are very, what we call small, very open economies, SVOEs, they are very dependent on foreign exchange savings and allocations. So if they spend less money on imports, and imports is a necessary and not, it's not a bug of the Caribbean economies, it's a feature of Caribbean economies. Importing goods is how Caribbean economies grow. That's a very important point. So therefore, if you save money on imports, that means you can reallocate all of that saved money to other fiscal priorities. So the cost savings that Caribbean countries gain because Chinese companies produce and are in the world is way more beneficial than any actual loan or actual infrastructure project PRC can give to these countries. So typically, when you mention this, that is completely glossed over. So I don't think there's any particular loan project or infrastructure project in most cases that would cause any kind of interest. The pure existence of goods and companies in the markets will actually, over time, increase the opportunity cost. It gets higher and higher for remaining a complete diplomatic ally of Taiwan. Because when you actually need to have good production imports and good, probably better trade deals and so on, and CARICOM as a group in general wants to have better trade deals over time, and some Caribbean countries are resisting because they remain Taiwan allies, that's going to cause a lot of political strife in their own domestic and regional politics. And over time, that will erode and erode and erode at the Taiwan allies remaining in the region. So yeah, I think that over time, just by very boring economic facts of life, that Taiwan will likely have no allies in the region through no fault of Taiwan.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up because it leads us nicely into the discussion about, China's influence in the Caribbean, specifically through aid and investment. So how successful have China's efforts been with regards to this? Do you have any sense of how Caribbean states view China, and specifically as it relates to debt trap diplomacy? Have you seen any evidence of this, and are these concerns valid?
I think the debt trap diplomacy conversation is a bit unfortunate in terms of Taiwan and Caribbean. Typically, of course, the debt trap conversation is about PRC and their misunderstood, at best, loan portfolios. But the problem is in Caribbean, there has actually been a debt trap problem, and that was actually Taiwan, which is one of the more unfortunate states of Taiwan-Caribbean relations. So back in 2004, there was a major hurricane that essentially destroyed a large part of Grenada. In some ways, it almost totally destroyed the country. And at that time, Grenada was a very strong ally of Taiwan, and Taiwan was its largest bilateral creditor. So it gave a lot of very good loans as well, useful loans at the time to Grenada, and Grenada was benefiting a lot from that relationship. Now, when the hurricane came, Hurricane Ivan, 2004, again, very bad hurricane, around 50% of people had no homes, the entire nutmeg production was gone, and at that time, Grenada was, I think, the second largest producer of nutmeg in the world, so it was a quite substantial crop for the income. Foreign income, again, as I mentioned, is very important to the country, and that was destroyed. Now, Grenada had asked for more loans and more money from Taiwan, from US and EU and so on. And they were not very receptive, those persons, those countries, and PRC, for various reasons, which also obviously include strategic reasons, decided to give Grenada a lot of loans and to help rebuild a lot of the country, which was again primarily gone by the hurricane. And for that reason, Grenada decided to break with Taiwan and go towards PRC as a formal ally. What happened then? Taiwan sued Grenada for all the loans that it gave to Grenada at a time when Grenada, she had no money to pay back loans. And Grenada tried to do what he called a debt restructuring program, and Taiwan refused for a decade to enter the program. And in that time, continued to sue the country, even prevented airlines and cruise ships from actually giving money, sending money back to the country for tourism receipts and so on. Very bitter battle between Taiwan and Grenada for a decade because of this political problem. And eventually, Taiwan rightfully relented and allowed Grenada to go into debt restructuring in 20, about 2013 or so. Now, when you talk about, when you bring up debt trap in the Caribbean, unfortunately, it's not a PRC problem, a Taiwan problem. So usually that's why I think people don't usually mention it when it comes to this conversation in the Caribbean. So if you're going to say debt trap, I think that's actually in as a more pro towards PRC in the Caribbean. I never had that, as say, bad press in the region, but Taiwan would have quite a bad press about that in the region. The second part of the question is, what could Taiwan do to shore up? Honestly, I don't want to sound like an economic determinist in this answer, but I don't think there's much that Taiwan can do. Again, it's not because it's a, let's say, a slight towards Taiwan's foreign policy or economic or organization. It's just that there are facts in the world, and small countries, as they are now, take a lot of benefit from Chinese goods, and that over time will have to inculcate a more business environment open towards Chinese markets. And usually, because Taiwan and PRC cannot coexist in small countries as both the recognized as diplomatic allies, because of that, Taiwan, I think, will lose out, especially in small countries. I don't think that's actually a bad thing for Taiwan. Of course, people have different interpretations of that. I don't think having, for example, I don't think for having formal allies that are essentially rocks in the ocean gives you much benefit in a global market. And of course, that's, almost a bit heretical to say, but I don't think it's a big loss for these small countries to not have Taiwan as an ally, formally speaking.
Sure, it's definitely an argument I've heard more and more recently about the value of these diplomatic partnerships and the pain caused by losing them. I want to turn now, we've talked about Taiwan, we've talked about China and their roles in the Caribbean. I'd like to talk a little bit about the United States, which obviously plays a big role in the region. How has the US historically and in recent years responded to China's greater interest in the region and Taiwan's presence in the region?
The US is trying to do a lot of things to prevent the expansion of PRC relations in the Caribbean. And, there are obvious reasons why that would be the case. Some of them are justified if I'm speaking from the perspective of the US. Of course, many are not justified if I'm speaking from the perspective of the Caribbean. And that's the tricky part of the question. So there are competing interests. And when they're competing interests, then they're competing incentives. So the US has this idea that they need to do more in the Caribbean to prevent the entrenchment of PRC interests in the Caribbean. This is somewhat correct, but the way most US foreign policy thinkers, even when I speak to various people in the State Department that work on Caribbean issues, I generally do not think that they have a correct orientation towards the key problem. The key problems have nothing to do with any pure state diplomatic action or activity in the Caribbean from the US. Very key problems are a lot larger. For example, when you're thinking about big issues in Caribbean, you would think about. Actually, I'm not sure what people do think about. I hear a lot of things, but one that's missed a lot is a very boring thing called correspondent bank de-risking. It's like a banking supervision topic. But for example, the former Minister of Finance at Dominica at the UN a couple of years ago, she mentioned that there are two existential risks in the Caribbean: climate change and correspondent bank de-risking. This issue essentially is when US banks, for various reasons, remove the accounts of Caribbean banks that are in the US and therefore does not allow Caribbean banks to send money via the US. As I mentioned earlier again, because everything in the Caribbean depends on the USD and foreign exchange to operate and function, this is a very big issue. You will have, for example, many Caribbean Washington-based diplomats mention things like this is a creeping cancer of US foreign policy in the Caribbean. You have ministerial meetings in the Caribbean about how to solve this problem. Actually, Maxine McLean, I'm not sure which terminology to use there, who's the head of the Finance Committee, was in Barbados last year talking about this issue with the Caribbean heads of state. It's a big issue. This is not an issue the State Department can do and solve. This is an issue of US tax policy. It's an issue of US extraterritoriality rules that are, for various reasons, will continue to expand. That's one example. So when the State Department talks about what it can do, it's not a very straightforward question, because the things that are really impacting Caribbean economies based on the US are not diplomatic. They're economic. They involve migration, for example. They involve things like lack of security cooperation. Those are much larger questions that don't usually have a diplomatic conversation. And because of that, I don't think the US puts much interest in figuring out how they can actually halt or at least minimize the advancement of PRC interests in the Caribbean. And I think they should have the more credible conversation about this topic. But I know I'm part of many of these conversations. I don't see it happening. That's something I would like to kind of influence change towards a more realistic, a more all-encompassing view of Caribbean foreign policy, but from the US side. But the problem is that when you think about foreign policy, people tend to think about embassies. And that's it's a bit late for that, in my view.
It's really interesting. And Rashid, I mean, I'd like to wrap it up there, but I think that is kind of a good note to go out on, that this really is a more complex matter than I think a lot of outside observers would give it credit for. I mean, like you said from the very beginning, the Caribbean is not a monolithic entity. It is this assemblage of very diverse states with very diverse interests that goes far beyond diplomacy. It goes to economic, security, so many other things. But I think you've done a great job of really providing a lot of context and shedding light on what is a very important region, both for Taiwan and China and the US. So, Rashid, thank you so much for joining us. Well, thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and all the interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, our frequent public seminars, and all of our other podcasts. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.